Hi, welcome to Forensic Forecast. As always, I'm Lee.
And I'm Simon.
We've had a lot going on the last couple of weeks, but we're back again. amazingly enough, I'm recording this on my Mac. For those of you who've been following me on Twitter, that's Schizofreud, S-C-H-I-Z-O-P-H-R-E-U-D. Yeah, for those of you who follow me on Twitter. Anyway.
What's Squitter?
Yeah, exactly. Shut up. You'll have heard or know that my Mac had a very unfortunate incident last week. My two-year-old son got hold of a glass of water and decided to pour it all over the computer while it was on. I feared the worst, but 2 days later, it managed to turn on and work again. It's a miracle. I'm sure of it. So,
well, it's both of us that have joined that club of knocking a, or having a drink knocked over on a laptop and still managed to get it working.
Yes. Well, I didn't do it to my own computer. That's the that's the difference between you and I.
Yeah, I didn't intentionally do it. It was my well, foot.
No, I'm sure you didn't intentionally do it. But yeah, it works, and I can't tell you how happy I am about that.
You must be glad to have a dishwasher-safe laptop.
Well, exactly right. I don't know how many people will know this, but apparently you can take a MacBook, stick it in a dishwasher, and if you leave it for like a week after you've done that, once it's all dried out, it will still work.
Is this where we say put in a disclaimer saying that we hold no responsibility if you decide to do something so stupid?
If people want to try and blame me for doing it, then they can go ahead. Because
don't try that at home.
Because it's mad. Anybody who does it needs to be certified. Honestly, I don't even know why they think what made them think that was a good idea to try it in the first place. But oh well.
Too much time, probably.
Well, that thought did cross my mind. Yeah. So, yeah. But besides that, I've been on an Enscript course just recently. And that yielded some interesting news as well, is that not only now am I a full-time forensic investigator, but I will also be instructing part-time at Guidance down in southern England as well. So if people don't like hearing me say, it's going to drive them mad.
You have to hope that that guy who left the comment on the podcast doesn't end up on one of your courses.
Oh, no, I hope he does. fun times. What have you been up to, Simon? Anything interesting?
Oh, no. I can't think of anything, actually. Just a lot of dealing with snow, really.
Yes, a lot of heavy snow over here at the moment, isn't there?
Yep.
Even though we only live about 40 minutes away from each other, we've hardly seen any here, and you get loads.
Yeah, that's because we're out in the, I guess, out in the hills where we're more likely to get it.
Yep. What about Windows 7, Simon? You've been trying that recently, haven't you?
Yeah, I've been having a bit of a play around with it. And if I mistakenly call it Windows Vista, then just take them to mean the same thing, because they essentially are, except for the fact that Windows 7's just a bit slimmed down, really, and a bit less sluggish.
Windows 7 actually performs, whereas Vista didn't.
Yeah, that's probably the big difference, really. There's some extra little interface things they've changed, and a few other features they've put in the beta that don't really work yet, and things like that. But it does have some interesting things in there. It's got a good way of, for example, troubleshooting programs for older versions of Windows and being able to run them as if you were running the program in Vista or XP or even anything before it.
Very good. So
it seems to work quite well, except for the fact that Windows 7, for the most part, I'm using it on my EPC and I've had to cut out about, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 gig of the installation to be able to fit it on. So nearly everything doesn't actually work. But other than that, it's great.
Yeah, well, you kind of lose your right to complain about how Windows 7 functions, really, if something goes wrong, if you've cut out most of the operating system.
Yeah, see, I did that, and then just a couple of days ago, I foolishly followed the advice of someone on a forum and used CCleaner on it, which I don't think's really been designed for use on Windows 7, and so took with it half of my program files. So I had to reinstall nearly everything to get any use out of the thing.
What a brilliant wiping program that is.
I know, it's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's almost as good as Clean Sweep, if you remember that. Quick Clean Sweep that said, this file isn't used very much, do you want to delete it? You delete it and realise it was a system file for a Clean Sweep.
Fantastic. Yeah, this is a brilliant piece of software. It'll clean itself off your system.
Yeah.
It can be yours for only $49. Dear. What a joke. So, anyway, yeah. Seeing as I'll be joining Guidance part-time, you may have thought that my bias against Access Data Forensic Toolkit was a bit above and beyond before, but you ain't seen nothing yet, baby.
Employer loyalty, yay!
I'm of course lying. I'm not gonna. I only say what I actually do think, and you know. Anyway, it's going to be interesting to see how all this works out. As I don't exactly live close to the place and everything, but it's something I've always wanted to do. So I'm really happy that I'm going to have the opportunity. So yeah, looking forward to it. And so, anyway, well, I guess we'll move on and we'll talk about some things which people want to hear about, really.
I suppose so.
Yeah. Should we start with Sarah Palin?
We shall.
All right, fair enough. You may all have heard a few months ago that Sarah Palin's Yahoo email account was hacked. It was found out that she'd been using her personal email for official state business, which is not looked upon favourably.
It's not a good idea anyway, is it really?
Well, no. And what happened is that a student had from the University of Tennessee had got hold of the email address of Mrs. Palin and had gone in, looked at like the secret questions and everything to reveal her password, looked at all the answers on the internet and had gained access to said email account, posted the new password up on the internet for everybody to see, and as well as all the emails, and basically caused a great deal of upset and disruption. Now, come to find out that this this student who did this, son of a Democratic leader in the state of Tennessee. So, cue the interesting story.
Yeah.
Now, it looks as if Wade Davies is a country singer. Wade Davies, on behalf of the University of Tennessee, has said that the warrant given to the FBI to investigate the student was too broad and essentially that these FBI specialists went fishing, essentially, is what they call it, where they didn't have any clear idea of what they were going in to find. And so they investigated everything on the computer. And he's claiming that shouldn't have been allowed to happen. Now, I'm sure a lot of people listening to this will think, ah, this can't be allowed to pass. You know, they've been... The prosecution have been given until the 13th of February to respond to this. And I wonder exactly what's going to come of it, because you can imagine that if this all went through, as Mr. Davies says, there's going to be some serious restrictions imposed upon forensic investigators in the future, isn't there?
Well, yeah, I suppose there is. I just wonder. I mean, I hope it's not going to be a kind of thing where people decide to do this kind of phishing all the time and just say, well, we've got a computer here, I want it investigating for every crime, because that could take some time.
Well, it could, but that's a fair point, but like, if you get a warrant to go and investigate people's physical files in like a filing cabinet, for example, then that's fair enough, isn't it? Because you'll take out the files, you'll read them, you'll determine if they're relevant to the case or not, and those that are relevant, you take away, those that aren't, you leave. But is it that simple on a computer? Because people can delete files, but the content can still be there. So the student could have done all this, deleted all of the traces of him doing it, and it's all been rendered to unallocated space. And if the FBI hadn't gone fishing, so to speak, how would they have ever found that information?
Yeah, I guess it's difficult to say, really. They probably wouldn't have found anything on there.
No. I think the computer cases are significantly different to your standard case, aren't they? Because you're not just talking about the actual normal everyday files. You're talking about anything which has ever really existed on that computer, whether it's live or deleted. Then there's a risk of a serious precedent being set with this particular case. Because if this goes through, imagine going to seize a computer somewhere, and you got the warrant for it, you take it back, you do the investigation. And I know, I can see kind of where they're coming from with this, because you don't want to take... You just don't want to do like a blanket search for stuff, but surely you're going to put obstacles in the way of actually completing a successful job, I think.
Yeah, I don't know, it could really go either way, couldn't it, when you think about it, and you're just not really sure either way how it's going to work out in the favour of forensic investigators.
Yeah. But it just seems as if the people are starting to tighten the grip on digital forensics as a whole. And I just wonder how easy it's going to be to actually do the job that we're employed to do in the future. Because if challenges like this are going to start coming up, then we're going to have to really consider how we go about our job. It just doesn't sit right with me.
Well, the thing is, the majority of investigations we get, we're provided with certain exhibits that we look at for a specific thing, and the authority and the approval is there to look for that specific thing. As soon as we start branching outside of that, then we're on dangerous ground anyway. And if we do find anything else, then it's a case of going back and making sure we have the authority to look for the thing that we've discovered and see if that forms a separate kind of line of inquiry for anything.
Yeah. Part of this thing which Davis said in this letter was, once seized, the government exceeded the scope of its authority by examining all of the computer's contents without the judicial approval to do so. Now, obviously, not having seen the warrant ourselves, it's difficult to comment on it, but if for example, you get a fraud case or something like that, what do you limit on what to look for?
Well, if you get a fraud case in, then there's going to be some kind of background to the case. There's going to be something else that they're going off as a lines of inquiry that you look for. If there's anything out, even remotely outside of that scope, then it's possibly beyond what you actually have to do as a forensic investigator.
No, it's understandable, but go to this fraud job, yeah, and say, for example, the intelligence for the job says we know this person has been producing false documents. We'd like to know if his computer was used to produce them. Now, say in these documents, you've got pictures of like bank logos. You've got pictures of signatures. You've got the actual documents themselves. You've got possible print spool files. You've got all kinds of different things that are possibly connected to this case. If they start restricting what you look at, how do you know you're going to get all of that evidence? How do you know that all those things are included in the scope of your investigation and you will be covered by the original warrant to do so?
I think it really depends on what kind of capacity you work in. But for us, work is outsourced from law enforcement to our company, and we do it and return it. I guess as far as we're concerned, we do what's written in the paperwork, essentially, and we do an investigation as far as what we've been asked to do. And anything beyond that, we just leave. But as far as whether or not there's going to be a limit on how much of a computer hard drive we look at or something, I think that would be a ridiculous kind of restriction to add, because that would essentially it could really be the death of a whole lot of investigations.
Yeah. Well, I also wonder about how detailed a warrant's going to have to get in order for you to see something and perform an investigation. These warrant, you know, a judge isn't gonna. If he reads a warrant and he doesn't understand it, he doesn't understand what the things mean on it. He's not gonna sign it. This is just gonna really overcomplicate the issue. If they're saying that, you gotta look at the other side at the same time, though. This is what really is so weird about it. You know that you don't want to be breaking. You don't want to be getting involved in any kind of privacy issues as well. And so you've got to say that if you went into an organisation and seized a bunch of computers, and they said, "Yeah, well, you can look at the organisational stuff, but there's personal documents on there as well that you're not entitled to look at."
That opens all sorts of doors, doesn't it, really? Because someone could easily move a file that proves their guilt in some kind of IP theft into a personal folder's sort of location and give it a name of something like My First Novel or something.
Yeah, no, but in private cases, that's fine.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter in private cases because you've got, you disclose certain things, and it's up to them to look at those certain items and determine the course of action from there. In criminal investigations, isolating certain things just seems just really, really peculiar.
Yeah, I think it's one of these things that shouldn't really have much of an impact, because, to be honest, no one really goes looking for personal information when they do forensic investigations. They look for what they're asked to look for, and they'll essentially just leave it at that.
Yeah.
Anyone that does start prying around or think, "Oh, look at these, look at all this stuff they've got on this computer," or whatever else, they're really on the edge of what they should be doing, really.
Yeah. Oh, I very much agree. But it seems as if, I don't know, there's potentially could be quite dangerous. This, I don't think it. I don't think that it will be looked upon favourably by a jury or a judge, really, because it is a blatant attempt to get the evidence thrown out, to get the kid acquitted, really.
Yeah.
But the potential, if if somebody doesn't really pay attention to what's going on here, it could be quite disastrous, because you can guarantee that'll be the collapse of hundreds of thousands of cases around the states.
Yeah, well, if you think about it in a more kind of real-world situation for law enforcement, if, say, someone's doing a raid on a house where they're suspected of, I don't know, possession with intent to supply drugs or something, and they've got this massive cannabis farm in their back bedroom or something, if they were limited in a warrant to just searching the living room of the house, it would be kind of pointless, wouldn't it, really? It doesn't seem to make any real sense. And so there's got to be some sense of realism and some sense of fairness for computer forensics compared to every other part of the legal process.
Yeah, I mean, if you go back to the filing cabinet analogy, yeah? If you take a file out of that and destroy it, it's destroyed. There's no way of recovering it. And that does not apply to digital forensics.
No.
It's just, I don't know. I think that I'm hoping they're barking up the wrong tree here, and that things will die down, and a proper trial will go ahead.
Yep.
But we shall see. Mm-hmm. Yeah, a country which passes those PI laws. We've just lost Luby. All right. Have you got that interesting article about France yet?
I have, yes. Yeah, it's kind of an interesting story, I thought. On the Register, on the 30th of January, they posted a story saying that 1 million French people were out of work thanks to mistakes with databases held by the government or various organisations that work for the government. And it's essentially their equivalent to kind of criminal records bureau checks, if you like. It's the kind of checks that you do for people who work in schools or people who have jobs that require some sort of level of checking their criminal history, really.
Yeah.
And they've said that over the period of a few months, I forget exactly when, one of their databases has allowed for the misclassification of 1 million people who were in fact innocent of anything and have been flagged as potential past offenders for things. So that's 1 million people throughout France who have applied for, well, you've got to get these kind of checks for all sorts of jobs these days.
Well, like you said, there's teaching, for one. Any time you work with children anyway.
Even a cleaner in a school, you've got to do it.
Yeah, exactly.
So this could be anyone.
Forensic investigators, especially for stuff like that.
Yeah, well, I guess it's probably the initial part of any kind of vetting procedure you go through for becoming a forensic investigator. And so to have 1 million people who have potentially never done anything wrong in their lives, all of a sudden being told, well, you haven't got this job because...
we think you have a criminal record.
Yeah. It's kind of crazy.
I'm sure it'll come as quite as a surprise.
Yeah, I'm sure it would have done.
No, we're not going to hire you because you're a criminal. What? No, I'm not.
Yeah. And so that's really quite dangerous, I think, more because if you think of the other side of it, you just kind of flip it around and say, well, if they've got 1 million people that have shown up as being guilty when they should have shown up as innocent, whether they've had anyone that's shown up as innocent that are in fact guilty of something.
Oh, dear. That,
that you can see the dangers of these kind of things. And then The other danger of this is the fact that in the UK we're planning on instituting a very similar system.
Woohoo.
Hmm.
What a brilliant idea.
Yeah. That really, to me, is staggering. That's 1 million people. And you think about that, the kind of population of France, the number of people that would be applying for jobs that would require this kind of vetting process, that's really not that small a percentage.
Oh, well, I would imagine that's a significant percentage.
Well, I did some sort of, not based on any kind of proper statistics, but I kind of did a rough estimation in my head, and what is it, 60 million? Is it 60 million people live in France? Something like that. I don't know, when it boils down to it, you're probably looking at 10% or more of people who apply for these jobs who have been shown as having a criminal record when they don't have one.
And that's just the ones we know about.
Yeah.
And there's possibly people who have been vetted who have criminal records that came up as a negative as well, of what you're saying, so... Oh, dear. I'm so pleased we're going to be having something like that over here as well.
Let's hope they reconsider, or they at least really try and learn from mistakes of other people.
Well, when you're on topic of databases, actually, I didn't want to bring up something else. And this potentially is going to horrify some people. But a couple of weeks ago, the UK launched a new database which holds the records of every single English child, sorry. Every single one of them. Their birth date, their address, their name, their local GP, the school they attend. It's all in one large database.
Well, isn't that a great idea?
Well, I think it's superb, yeah.
You look at our recent history for data leaks in the UK, and it really is, it's quite shocking in comparison to other countries, to be honest.
Well, all right, well, let's take a step back here then, shall we? Right, a couple of years ago, the UK government lost two CDs of unencrypted information, which basically held on an entire list of people who have support from the government. Now, that support was what we call in the UK child tax credits, which means basically you get some of the tax you pay, you get it back depending on how many children you have and stuff like that. It's a bit like a tax rebate, I suppose. But they lost all that information. Now, in their wisdom, what then happened is that they sent out letters to all the people whose information had been lost. And this letter, which they sent out to everybody, said, "This is the information that we've lost about you." And they listed it all in this letter that could have been intercepted by anybody.
Sent out by our standard postal service.
Yeah. I mean, who thought that was a good idea?
But it's making a bad situation potentially worse, isn't it?
It's ridiculous. And so, going back to this database of all the children in England, that's enough information for one child that, you know, you can really cause problems. If you want to kidnap a child or something like that, you have all the information there that you want. Now, it's all right, though, because the government says this is a hack-proof system.
Oh, well, that makes me feel a lot safer.
Brilliant, isn't it? Yeah. I don't know how they've managed to accomplish this, because nobody else in the world has managed to figure out how to create a hack-proof system.
Well, and I can guarantee one of those things, isn't it? Even if you manage to make the perfect system that cannot be hacked in any kind of normal way, someone's going to find a way in. Hopefully, when we get someone like, when we get Johnny Long on the podcast at some point in the future, one of the things he's gone around lecturing and presenting about is no-tech hacking, where with the aid of things like a wire coat hanger and things, you can quite often find your way into secure buildings. So you can't defend against absolutely everything. It's just not possible. if you get all the tech stuff, you're going to miss some no tech stuff.
Yeah. And
you're never going to have a hack-proof and bulletproof data system.
Now, but the thing is, though, is that the average person will read that article and be like, oh, that's great, as long as it's hack-proof, that's fantastic. But they don't understand. You know, people who work in the computing industry will read that statement and be like, are you completely off your rocker? That's the stupidest thing I ever heard.
Yep.
And you can guarantee, as soon as that database went out, that tens of thousands of Chinese hackers were on their computers already trying to break in.
Well, I think there's only one way to guarantee a system of any kind can't be hacked, and that's to...
Leave it off.
Well, it's to have it off, or to have it completely disconnected from everything else in the world.
Yeah.
Like, for example, our company database at work contains case information, but because in order to get a police contract over here, you've got to have a network that's completely separate from anything that connects to the internet. Thereby, anything on it can't be accessed if anything on the internet's hacked.
Yeah, no, but even then, you think about a disgruntled employee and go in and can copy the contents off.
Yeah.
So, I still don't think there's such a thing as 100% secure. And
no.
Yeah. But this is just another one of those things on the list that we're being forced into that doesn't really seem to make a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
Another interesting story last couple of weeks was that I can't remember. I meant to look this up beforehand and I couldn't remember where it was. But some guy in London has been going around with a cheap RFID scanner and has been basically copying people's passports. He managed to successfully clone two RFID passports.
Isn't that great?
Just from a standard RFID reader that he bought off eBay. So, it's just... all these things are supposed to make our lives simpler and better, just and are supposed to make us less of a target for identity thieves.
Well, just wait until they start putting biometric information on passports.
Well, yeah. It just goes to show that, you know, we are going to run into difficulty with identity theft regardless, so...
Yep.
Anyway, we'll move on to the next item now, rather than get onto another rant.
Yeah.
I think that horse has already bolted anyway.
Yeah.
But, okay. As if our bright, rosy world of computer forensics wasn't already tainted enough, new disk encryption standards...
Yay.
Being implemented onto most major manufacturers' hard drives by default, so that if you try to get any information off them without entering a pre-boot decryption key, you will just get a load of jumbled up data. Hooray!
That is just such a good idea on so many levels.
Well, it is, though. That's the really annoying thing. It is a brilliant idea. I would want it.
It's a brilliant idea until you lose your password. Well, they're still in a very early development stage of this, really.
Yeah.
And so hopefully they're going to rethink this. But at the moment, if a password's lost, that's it. Goodbye data. Which, I don't know, that... The thing is, people are going to find ways to back up their information, aren't they? People are going to back up their information onto other drives, possibly external drives. If they know that if they forget the password, they've lost everything. What's to say they're going to back it up onto an encrypted drive anyway?
Mm.
So you've still got to rely on users when you build these systems, and that's something they've got to bear in mind.
Well, from a computer security standpoint, it is a brilliant idea. I mean, absolutely. But whatever's good for computer security typically isn't that great for computer forensics.
No, not
on
really.
The whole, really. And this kind of thing, unless you've got a law in place that will force somebody to reveal the passphrase, you're really going to struggle, because this is going to be high-level encryption, which could possibly take millions of years to try and decrypt. Or you could always go out and try and create a quantum computer.
That would probably be easier.
Yeah, well, yeah, unfortunately.
The thing is, we have such a law in this country now, don't we, regarding the giving up of passwords, but we've discussed it before. The punishment for not disclosing a password doesn't in any way come close to the punishment you might face if you actually give your password up.
Yeah.
And
like you said, there's also the chance that somebody will forget their password as well. And if that happens, then, you know, how do you know they're lying?
Well, you can't.
Well, exactly. So, I'm sorry, I forgot my password.
Did you put people in prison for accidentally forgetting something?
I don't know. I think it's crazy. But, I mean, what's the alternative? Is there an alternative? A viable one?
Well, I don't know.
But the good thing about this disk encryption is that it's not going to be enabled by default. I'm sure a lot of people will be familiar with ATA drive locking and stuff like that, which is now, I mean, that's standard stuff in a hard drive. But how often do we see it used?
Yeah.
Once in every thousand, couple of thousand cases?
Yeah.
I really don't think that people are going to enable this by default, because who wants to remember another password on top of what's already there, especially when you've already got stuff in place which you know... You know, you can. I see. I think about the enterprise. The enterprise benefits of this. Well, enterprise drawbacks, really, more than anything else, because if you're rolling out encryption standards on all your hard drives, it's going to be a real pain in the neck to maintain that, isn't it? Because every single drive is potentially is going to have a different password. If you make them all the same, everyone's going to know what the password is, so it makes it completely useless in the first place.
Mm.
So, I can't imagine the drives will be intelligent enough to have any kind of enterprise password management on there, really.
I don't know. It's strange, because if it's a password that's built into it already, then surely you've got to write that on something to be able to give that to the end user.
I suspect that you will have to do that yourself rather than them providing you with it. But, yeah. It's unlikely this will get implemented into very many computers, because it's another thing that people have to remember on top of, you know, their password for their online banking, their Windows login, and all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah.
I've just seen ATA locking. It doesn't happen very often, and I don't see a lot of people using it, but it's just something to be made aware of, I think, more than anything else.
Yeah, well, going back a couple of years, when we were hearing about some of the final features of Vista when that was due to come out, there was a lot of concern over things like BitLocker.
Yeah.
And not only the fact that there'd be systems where you could enable this quite easily, but there would also be systems with some kind of key built into a motherboard to be able to decrypt it on power up.
Yeah.
Meaning that the only way to get into that certain hard drive is to load it up in that computer.
Yeah.
Which hasn't really turned into the major problem that people thought it might do.
No, I think I've only heard of one person having a case that involved BitLocker.
Yeah.
And
one other thing on here that is a slight concern to me, because I don't know what they mean by a certain word, is saying that with some password settings, you can provide a password that allows erasure, so that you can put the drive back into use. So, in other words, if someone asks you for a password, if you've got a standard password and say a wiping password, you give them your wiping password. that's potentially a problem.
Yeah, that'd be a brilliant one, wouldn't it? So, Mr. Jones. Your password seems to have your hard drive seems to have a password on. Would you care to share with us that password? Well, I don't really remember. It's one of two.
See, that's a nightmare situation, isn't it? Really.
One of them will erase the hard drive. One of them will get you access. I can't remember which one is which, to be perfectly honest. Who wants to take the risk?
No.
No, absolutely not. Crazy stuff. Mm-hmm. Or you could just, you could actually just psych them out, really, couldn't you, in that case as well?
Yeah, you could do.
You should be like, oh, well, you could just give them two fake passwords instead.
So. Although, you're probably in an alright situation as a forensic investigator if that ever happened. Because you could just do an image of the encrypted drive, couldn't you?
Oh, no, but you don't get access to the drive until you've entered the password. You won't be able to image it until you've...
Okay, so this is the idea of disabling the drive rather than just encrypting it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's all extremely interesting. Will we see it? I hope not. But be prepared in case we do. So, and moving neatly on from that, it's you may want to get one of those hard drives anyway if you're gonna be committing more crimes, which is what they reckon is going to be happening in the very near future, according to an article on the BBC. Cybercrime is at an all-time high. Costs $1 trillion a year. It doesn't say who to, admittedly, but and it says that it's going to get significantly worse due to the current economical situation. Now, all I have to say to that is,
And what else is new?
Are we supposed to be surprised by this? But it is something we have to really look at. It's quite amusing, actually, because, well, I'm sure it's not amusing for some people.
No.
But as the world declines in its financial stability and stuff like that, where you see a lot of companies going and having some serious problems, work for people like us has really not been better, has it?
Oh, business is booming.
Yeah. And there's so much work coming in because more people are turning to white-collar crime and even just regular crime just behind a computer. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, the two things that are going to help this situation, as stupid as it might sound, is if the economy gets a whole lot better or the economy gets a whole lot worse. If the economy gets a whole lot better, people don't turn to crime as much. If it gets a whole lot worse, they can't afford the internet bills to enable them to do the cybercrime.
Interesting point. Well, I know which one I prefer it to be quite honest.
Yes, I know.
So, yeah. But, yeah, interesting, but so what? we knew this was going to happen.
The thing is... we watch BBC News from time to time, and just a few weeks ago, just on a standard crime sort of issue, they were saying that with the recession hitting, that crime rates had gone up. And they seemed to talk about that as if that wasn't really expected. And people were saying it's more complicated than that. And I'm thinking, how is it more complicated than that?
I don't see how it is. What?
No.
We're not criminologists. We're not economists, even.
No.
Either. So
we think about all these things in a very simplistic kind of way.
Yeah.
I think that's probably as much as my brain can handle with that kind of subject, to be honest.
Yeah. We're like the Luddite version of financial analysts. So, anyway, moving on from that, as it was such a duh story. Well, we're going to revisit the Julie Amaro case.
Yay! Was this the third time?
Yeah, I think so. And it's interesting this time because the guy, police detective Mark Lounsbury, it looks like he's gone on and he's started a blog and he's written about the case. Now, we can't say for sure that it's him who's written this, but other people seem to think that it is, so we'll talk as if it is him. But he's put this post up, and he says, essentially, I don't really care what everybody else thinks. I don't care what your opinions are. This is fact. This is what I know to be true and to be right. And this is what really happened. And I don't know why. Why would you put yourself out there like that? The case is over. Julia Merrill...
It's flogging a dead horse, well, isn't it, really?
She's been through so much already, right? It's quite ridiculous because she was 7 months pregnant when all this happened. She had serious problems with her pregnancy due to stress over this. She's had serious health issues connected with stress over this. In the end, she wanted it to be over so badly that she took a lesser... She pled guilty to a lesser crime. It was not even a crime, it was a misdemeanor, I think. And... Now, why would this guy come back and say, well, this is what really happened? When the only person we have to validate what he says is him.
Yep.
I mean...
As far as expert testimony goes, that's not the best position to be in.
No. I think you really... If this guy really should be writing a blog on how to ruin your own credibility. Because, I mean, reading all the other things which happened associated with the case, the people who have since... done their own analysis and have reviewed Mr. Lounsbury's report, it's obvious that the aspects of the investigation that weren't thorough, that weren't done properly, and that led to, lack of a better word, innocent woman being dragged through this terrible court case, when in reality she most likely did not have anything to do with what was happening on that computer. And then to come out after this case is already gone, you know, it's over, and come out and try and dig it up more and have a poke at people, it's childish. Why?
Yeah. I don't think this article you've referred to, was it on InfoWorld?
It is on InfoWorld, yes.
Yeah, it's obviously a biased sort of point of view, but it's quite funny, some of the phrases that are used in it.
Well,
isn't, who do you believe, this guy or a team of 7 highly experienced computer security experts?
It is biased. But like most of the stuff that we read, that you read on the internet, is going to be at least a little bit biased. But I don't understand the mentality of dragging it up.
No.
And the reason that I'm dubious as to whether this guy or not is because this was on a Blogspot blog, and was removed.
Set them up by anyone.
And it was, it could be set up by anybody, and it was removed very, very quickly. Now, why would it be removed quickly? I don't think Google would have done that, because that's censorship, and there's this whole not evil thing going on. So, I suspect that it wasn't him. It's somebody trying to make him look a little bit worse than he's already been made to look.
More than likely.
So... I don't know, that's my opinion. But, I might be as credible as a witness as him. So, anyway, moving on. Have you ever sold anything on eBay? Anything computer related which might have some digital storage on? If so... Did you wipe it first? A recent study conducted by Kessler International showed that out of 40% of hard drives which they purchased off eBay on three different occasions. The percentages out of that 40% broke down to the following. Personal and confidential documents, including financial information, 36%. Emails, 21%. Pictures, 13%. Corporate documents, 11%. Internet browsing histories, 11%. DNS server information, 4%. Miscellaneous data, 4%. They're all things which were found on hard drives being bought and sold on eBay. Now, I mean, unfortunately, it's another one of those type articles, isn't it? Mm-hmm. But it shouldn't be.
It's easy enough these days. There's so many free utilities out there that can wipe files. So there's not really much of an excuse for not doing it.
No. Well, it brings up an interesting argument. I don't know how many people follow the forensic forums and stuff, but there are a lot of contentious... This is a contentious area. Wiping and formatting and stuff. Some people think that formatting is enough and that people won't be able to get very much back after you've done that. Some people think that you should wipe. Some people think that people who create tools for wiping things are the spawn of the devil and should all be cast back down to hell from whence they came.
Well, Guidance in Case has a wiping utility.
Yes, I know. I'm not saying I support that point of view. I've noticed it. But wiping software has had some very valid purposes, as can be seen from this study.
Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, you talk about 11% of 11% of that 40% were corporate documents that were recovered. I wonder how many sysadmins heads would roll if people found out their information had been bought on eBay.
Yeah.
Could be very interesting to find that out anyway. But, yeah. So, it's tempting, because I'd now like to go onto eBay and buy some computer hard drives and just see exactly what's on there. In fact, I think we probably should do that at some point in the future, you know, Simon.
Yeah, that could be an interesting little project.
We'll find out. And we'll post all of the results on the website. yes.
I'm just looking through this article.
I don't want to go to prison, so we won't do that.
Looking at this article, it did say one particular hard drive contained an astonishing amount of fetish pornography, along with your name, address, and personal information belonging to the original owner. And that has other connotations in the UK now, with the extreme pornography law passing. And you think you could easily buy a hard drive off eBay, get it home, connect it up, and find what's essentially a whole bunch of illegal stuff on there.
Well, yeah, you could do that anyway, couldn't you? Even without the extreme pornography, there could be anything on these hard drives that you buy. I personally wouldn't recommend buying a used hard drive off eBay. I think that's the risk you take.
Well, hard drives aren't exactly expensive to buy new these days, are they?
No.
So I don't personally see why you'd really need to go looking on eBay for a used hard drive. Unless you didn't know it was used and you thought it was new.
Well, we've seen that happen before as well, haven't we? We've seen people buy what they think is a new hard drive, take it home, and find out that it's been used already. And it's got all kinds of information on. Mm-hmm. People buy new computers that they think has got new hardware in and find out that the hard drives has got pictures of the previous owner's children or something like that. Mm-hmm. So it's all, you know, forensic investigators shouldn't ever fall into this trap, really, should they?
No, I wouldn't have thought they would.
And obviously, based on what we discussed last time, none of the hard drives you buy on eBay are going to be from the Ministry of Defence. unless they come in a bag as a fine powder.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Interesting. But, yeah. I wouldn't advise buying hard drives off eBay unless you are going to be conducting an experiment like that, really. Because who knows what you're going to find. But yeah, I'd like to do that. I think we should plan to do that sometime in the future.
I think it's funny that you say you wouldn't advise doing that in your very next sentence. You say,
but there's
like
a difference. There's a difference. It's an experiment. I don't mean, you know what I mean. Yeah. Knock it off.
I know, it just sounded funny. I thought I'd point it out.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to take the opportunity now, actually, to mention something.
Okay.
Simon has this little thing that he does at the office every day, which is he does this day in history, and he does random phobia of the day. And I wanted to find a phobia which was very, very funny that nobody would have heard of before. And so I typed into Google the irrational fear of people named Simon. And I got a hit. And it's the only name I found that's got a phobia related. And it's called Munkophobia. Munkaphobia. Munkophobia. Fear of people named Simon. And I hope that no one who listens to the podcast is munkophobic.
Well, the thing is, munkophobia is the irrational fear of people named Simon. And that's the thing to bear in mind.
Yeah, but I have a very legitimate fear of people named Simon.
A number of people may well have. You gave me an idea there. I wonder if it's worth putting my random phobia of the day on Twitter and see if people can guess it.
Oh, it's too late. I've already Twittered it. Mm. but speaking of Twitter, I have a joke for you, Simon.
Okay.
This is by Gyro. An SQL query walks into a bar and sees two tables. He walks up to them and says, "Can I join you?"
Okay.
Not even a fake laugh.
No.
In my defense, it's not my joke. I just thought it was funny.
I figured it wasn't your joke.
Yeah. So.
I can't even get onto how bad that joke is.
Shall I apologize now rather than save it for the next episode?
May as well get it out of the way.
Yeah. All right, well, we'll try and wrap this up now. Do you have your story?
I do. I have quite an interesting story, I think. I was kind of torn between two. I was torn between a wife who found out she'd been she was going to get divorced via Facebook, and the other one is the hacking of road signs in America. And so I went with the road signs one.
Okay.
I'm just going to read out the article. It says, US pranksters are hacking into electronic road signs to post hoax warnings, such as Nazi zombies and raptors ahead. The latest breach came during the morning rush hour near Colesville, Illinois, where a sign was changed to "Daily lane closures due to zombies." there was another one in Indiana's Hamilton County where a sign read "Raptors ahead." Another sign in Austin, Texas recently flashed "Nazi zombies, run!" And "Zombies in area, run!" This is according to the Daily Telegraph. I just thought that was quite funny because some of these things, you know, some of these roadside systems they have in America aren't brilliantly secure. They're red light cameras, for one, don't use a particularly secure system. I just think that's quite funny. Imagine heading out on your commute to work and seeing one of these signs and just thinking, okay, something like "road works ahead." And then it flashes up for "road closures due to zombies." And you look at it like, okay, zombies. And you're like, what? I just think it's so ridiculous, but so funny. And they have no idea how these signs are getting hacked.
There was somebody who figured out how to hack the GPS live systems as well, wasn't there? Just over a year ago. And there's different codes for these GPS systems that update themselves. And there's codes for ridiculous things. Like, there's codes for, like, alien invasion, nuclear explosion, or things like that. And so these people were driving along, intercepting the real-time updates from these GPS satellites, and then broadcasting them to their fellow drivers. So people would have been having things show up and having their route altered because there was an alien invasion going on in the next town.
Yeah.
Well, there'd been a nuclear missile.
Can't drive through Southampton. There's an alien invasion going on.
Yeah. So the GPS would reroute around the outside of the town.
That's quite funny.
I love it when they do stuff like this. It's wrong. It's very, very wrong. They're very naughty. They shouldn't do it.
Of course it is. Yeah.
But funny nonetheless.
In the words of Joe Gassaway, which I'm not even going to get into the name, from the Department of Transportation, he says, "We don't want drivers being distracted by a funny sign." So there you go. They believe that's those signs to have been hacked remotely, which kind of makes sense.
Great stuff. All right, well, a couple of items before we leave you. First off, I threatened last time that I was going to close the Forensic Forecast forum because it only had like 5 members. It's now about 30 members, and I keep getting requests for it. So I don't know what to do. It looks like you've tied my hands on this one. But I want to try a little experiment this time around. Don't give me any money. There. Done.
Yeah, I don't think you'll have the same kind of results somehow.
Cynic. So anyway, yeah, that's that bit down. The other bit I want to quickly talk about is that Larry Daniel, he is the author of one of the forensic blogs that we read quite often. He started to do almost like a radio show type thing on Blog Talk Radio, talking about forensic sciences as a whole. But each week he's going to be talking to different people, and he's going to be talking to people who deal with like the regular gruesome blood and guts forensics, people who deal with dogs and like the forensic work they do with those. Digital forensics are going to be one of the topics that he talks about. He's got a couple of guests lined up there. But it's well worth giving that a listen to. That address for that is www.blogtalkradio.com/talkforensics. And, yeah, give it a listen. We're recording this on Sunday night, and Larry's actually due to start doing this particular... his first episode in about 5 minutes' time. So it's available on there, either to listen live, if you want to listen live, or you can download it as a podcast through iTunes or download it off the site. But in order to keep this up, Larry has to have 500 downloads for every episode or something like that. So go on and download it. I know there's only like 5 people who listen to this podcast, so, I mean, but 5 should make a difference. Yeah, go ahead. It should be fun. As always, you can follow Simon and I on Twitter. As I said at the top of the show, my Twitter account is Schizofroid. That's Schizophreud. And Simon, you want to give yours?
Mine is EnglishGit. Spell it as you'd think it is. One word.
So, feel free to follow us on there. I'm a bit more interesting than Simon, as you can tell from what we talk about.
So, yeah, I hardly ever update my Twitter. I'm still getting used to it, really.
I think you've only ever talked about Windows 7 on there, haven't you? You haven't really said very much else.
And snow.
Windows 7 and snow. Marvellous. What a combination. So, anyway, thanks for listening and giving us your time today, and hopefully you'll listen again. So, we shall... talk to you soon. Bye for now.
Bye.